We have done so many programs on PTSD over the years, lost count of them. But tonight we're going to do another, where we're going to see it through an entirely different prism, provided by Sebastian Younger. Now, how can it be, dear listener, that only 10% of American forces see combat, yet the US military has the highest rate of post-traumatic stress disorder in its history, and probably in the world? And here's another statement for you. Well, we've heard a bit about this. For most veterans with combat trauma, the problem isn't so much the battlefield, but much closer to home. It's something that Sebastian, war correspondent, writer, documentary maker, has investigated and written about in his Vanity Fair article called The Bonds of Battle. Sebastian himself has suffered from PTSD after returning from a two-month assignment covering the war in Afghanistan. We'll get to that in a moment. You will know him from his documentaries on the Afghanistan conflict, Restrepo and Karengal, and also his book simply called War. And, of course, famously, he's the author of The Perfect Storm. He's on the blower from New York City. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Hi there, thank you.
Sebastian, the US military has the highest rate of PTSD in its military history. Is that simply because we know what it is? We can diagnose the disorder? Perhaps it was even more intense during the Civil War.
Well, it's hard to go back to a war like the Civil War because you're absolutely right. They weren't keeping very good records, and they had a very, I think, very simple psychological understanding. But certainly from the 20th century, what we've seen is that every war, thank God, casualties have plummeted. And you go from World War One to World War II, Vietnam, and then the current wars, casualties have gone down very, very steeply, which means the intensity of combat has dropped. And presumably the level of trauma that troops are exposed to has dropped. But strangely, with every war, disability claims have gone up precipitously, and many, they don't always break it out by what kind of claim it is, but in very, very large percentages PTSD. Now something like 50% of the military are claiming disability, much of it for PTSD, and only 10% of the military these days sees combat. So there's this huge gap. Some of it obviously is malingering, it's fraud, just people trying to claim disability benefits. And some of it is something else. And I think what I try to understand in the article is how is it that a soldier could not see combat, not be traumatized, and then come home and honestly feel out of place, like they don't belong, like they'd rather be back in the war. Like what is going on there?
Well, we're going to investigate that in our conversation, but let's just have a reality check. You talk about the Israel's defense forces, where the rate is as low as 1%, despite the fact that they're on constant alert for long periods of time.
That's right. I'm studying anthropology in college, and having been with the U.S. military quite a bit, I had this idea, and seeing these PTSD claims, I had this idea that maybe the levels of PTSD in a military are a function not of the level of trauma on the battlefield, but a function of something else, something in society back home, not appreciation. American soldiers are enormously appreciated back home, but something else, something about the cohesiveness of society. I did my field work on the Navajo Reservation in the western United States, and I had this idea, the Navajo, the Apache, the Comanche, when they're fighting in the 1800s, when they're fighting each other in the U.S. cavalry, they probably weren't coming back to camp with PTSD. It was something I couldn't prove, but it was an idea that I had, and that was how I started looking into Israel.
Well, the results are absolutely fascinating. I, in the decades I've been doing this program, again and again, a phenomenon has swept through the world of psychiatry or public response to pressure. RSI, for example, comes to mind. All of a sudden, people, in a sense, were permitted to have RSI, and so it exploded. Suddenly everybody had it. You know, I was searching for symptoms in myself. Do you think that to some extent you're describing something along that line, that the society has given permission to have PTSD?
I think there's a bit of that. I think previous generations were quite stoic. As stoic as they were, they still apply, if they were servicemen or women, they still applied for disability if they felt they deserved it. And but certainly the sort of common idea of, oh, if you're in the military, you're traumatized and you get PTSD. And then PTSD gets sort of mythologized. I've heard people say that you can get PTSD just by knowing other people with PTSD, or you can get PTSD just because you think you might be in danger, even if you never are. All of those ideas are absurd. So it gets mythologized and inflated for a number of reasons, I think.
You make the point absolutely emphatically that anthropological research from around the world shows that recovery from war is heavily influenced by the society one returns to. And you quote Sharon Abramitz from the University of Florida, another anthropologist, who says, "We're not a good society." And by society, she's talking about your society. But I'm pretty persuaded, much the same applies to Australia, that we are increasingly an anti-human society.
Yeah, what Abramitz meant was that modern society is deeply alienating of people. We're animals, we're primates specifically. We're a very, very social species. And the wealthier a society, not just America, but any modern society, the wealthier a society, the more individualistic people's lives are. They can make choices for themselves. They can move to California away from their family. They don't necessarily function for the greater good of the community. They're doing jobs and living their own lives. Their welfare is not tied up with that of others. So of course we didn't, as a species, we didn't evolve for that kind of life. We evolved to live in some kind of communal setting with interreliant with one another in groups of 30 or 40 or 50 individuals.
And then you contrast this with life in the military, where you are virtually never alone. Day after day, month after month, you are close enough to speak to, if not touch, a dozen or more people. You eat together, you sleep together, laugh together, suffer together.
Exactly. And that's basically what we evolved for as a species. When I was with American soldiers in eastern Afghanistan in 07, 08, it was a 20-man position on a ridge with a lot of combat. It was very remote. There wasn't any electricity for a while. It was very, very rough. But I could reach out my arm and touch three other men from where I slept at night. That's how humans evolved to live. It's a very, as cramped as it can be, it's a very, very secure way to live. And when people come back from that experience to a modern society, they're suddenly sleeping by themselves in a room. They have their own house. They're leading their own lives. It's terrifying because it's completely individual. And that's what Abramowitz meant by it's an anti-human society. It goes against
She writes quite beautifully, "Our society is alienating, technical, cold, and mystifying. Our fundamental desire as human beings is to be close to others, and our society does not allow for that. And in fact, all the so-called social media is in a curious way intensifying that problem."
I mean, my opinion is that, yes, it is intensifying that problem. Dr. Abramowitz said that to me when I interviewed her a few months ago. And what we were discussing was not just PTSD, but general levels of mental illness in society. So as income goes up, as wealth goes up in a society, the ability to choose individual lives goes up, and also so does the suicide rate, depression rate, anxiety, insomnia, child abuse. All of these issues go up with income. That's the society that soldiers come back to. Even if they didn't see combat, they come back to that kind of society from the very intense platoon experience that you would even have on a rear base.
Sebastian, this program is technically called LNL, which is short for Late Night Live, but I changed the name to suit the context. Very often I call it LNL because we're a bit left-wing and bulging. Tonight I'm going to call it Alienl because that seems to fit even better. My guest is Sebastian Junger, and he's written a marvellous essay for Vanity Fair, The Bonds of Battle. Just when I sometimes despair of Vanity Fair, particularly since our old mate Christopher Hitchens has passed on, they do a zinger like this, and it's a great treat to have you on the program. Tell us about the White Indian, Sebastian.
Well, that was a very interesting thing. In our history in the United States, there was this phenomenon that really puzzled and embarrassed the settlers and the white society here. It was noted by Benjamin Franklin and other writers and thinkers of the time that young men, particularly, but young women as well, who were kidnapped by the Indians along the frontier as teenagers, even as adults, when given the chance to return to white society, almost always refused. They didn't want to leave. And that, worse than that, young men were also continually fleeing white society and basically adopting an Indian lifestyle, moving in with these ostensibly hostile Indian tribes. And it never went the other way around. The American Indians were not fleeing across the frontier to become farmers and plow fields and live a quote, civilized life.
We did some programs on this years ago, Sebastian, and I remember when women hostages, allegedly, were taken back from tribes, white women, they were very reluctant to go and often had to be removed by force.
That's right. There was a treaty at Fort Pitt in western Pennsylvania, and there were dozens, maybe a couple of hundred captives of the Iroquois Nation who had to be repatriated in accordance with the treaty. And some of them had to be tied, and many of them were women, had to be tied on horseback to be brought back to the colonials. So, of course, that flew in the face of white society's and Christian society's idea of itself as a superior culture. Why would a white person who had been kidnapped by the Indians possibly be reluctant to return back to colonial society? It's impossible. But in fact, that was the case. And so I talk about this because I say maybe veterans returning from war, many of whom, I would say the majority of whom, at least say that they miss that experience. They want to go back to it. I compare them to the white Indians. I say maybe they're the modern white Indians who want to go back to a more intimate, cohesive life that they experienced over there.
Now, Sebastian, you've experienced PTSD. Tell us how that happened and what it meant for you.
I mean, anyone who's been traumatized will have a reaction to that, a temporary reaction to that trauma. It's a normal, healthy thing. Car accident, bad divorce, I'm sure. Anything like that is traumatic and affects people. I was in northern Afghanistan about a year before 9/11. I first went to Afghanistan in 1996. I went back in 2000. I was with Massoud's forces of the Northern Alliance. They were battling the Taliban. And a number of very, very upsetting things happened. There was a lot of combat. But one day in particular stood out in my mind. We were on a hilltop position that the Northern Alliance had just taken over from the Taliban. And the Taliban were preparing to counterattack, and they started that with a long rocket barrage. And we were curled up in the fetal position in trenches, getting hammered by Katyusha rockets for 45 minutes or an hour. And it was extremely unpleasant. And I got, I got back to the United States, and one day I went down into the underground to take the subway, and it was rush hour, it was crowded, and loud, and a lot of people, and situation I've been in many times. I live in New York, but this time I completely panicked, and I felt, I really can say, as scared or more scared than I'd ever been in Afghanistan. I thought the train was going to kill me, that the crowd was going to kill. I didn't know what the threat was, but I felt in deadly danger.
And it sounds like all your nerve ends were extended, that all your perceptions were wildly exaggerated.
That's right. And I had it in a ski gondola. I just kept having these panic attacks, and they seemed to be situations where I was not in control. where I felt out of control. Nothing, none of them had to do anything to do with Afghanistan, my experience in Afghanistan, but there were situations where I was not in control and overwhelmed by sensory experience. And it, you know, gradually went away. But I remember, you know, over the next few months, I stopped having them. I recovered. I had no idea. I just thought I was going crazy. I had no idea what PTSD was. I did not connect it to the war at all. And I talked to a lady at a party who was a psychologist, and she asked about my war reporting. She said, have you had any emotional consequences from that? I said, no. But for some reason, I described the panic attacks, and I still didn't connect it to the war. And she said, this is 2003. We just invaded Iraq. And she said, that's something called PTSD, and you'll be hearing quite a lot about it.
Incidentally, when was the term coined? When did it come into common parlance?
At some point after the Vietnam War, I think around 1980, I can't remember exactly, but it was fairly recently.
Yeah, so shell shock in World War I, PTSD after Vietnam. Other foreign correspondents have been on the program report the same phenomenon, that they sort of got through the major crisis, but the wallop came when they were back home. Do you ever fully recover from it?
I mean, PTSD, the last word in that is disorder. And by that, I think it means that your life is impaired by your reaction to trauma. So in that sense, yes, my life is not impaired by my reaction to trauma. That doesn't mean that I don't have associations and reactions that are different from other people who haven't been traumatized, but I wouldn't call it a disorder.
Sebastian, you write that roughly 80% of people exposed to terrible events will recover, more or less. And this makes sense if you consider the extreme hardships and violence of our prehistory. It makes sense, you say, that humans are able to sustain enormous psychic damage and continue to function. Otherwise, we would have died out.
Exactly. I mean, we're designed to survive, right? We're primates. We evolved in a very harsh environment. And if we couldn't psychologically recover from trauma, the species wouldn't exist. We wouldn't be here. So roughly 20% of, I mean, I would say almost 100% of people have an immediate reaction to trauma, like I did. But only about 20% develop a long-term problem with it, which would be called PTSD. Which is way, way lower than the rates that are being claimed by servicemen today in America.
There are studies that show that different experiences trigger either acute or chronic PTSD. You had acute short-term PTSD, didn't you? That was self-diagnosis or objective diagnosis?
Well, I like to think it was both. But yes, I didn't go to talk to anyone about it, but... I trusted the woman that I talked to at this party that the symptoms were classic PTSD, and then I sort of watched it go away. But like I said, I didn't lose all of the effects. I kept re-traumatizing myself covering war, and I had some pretty significant consequences from it after I was with some American platoons in 07-08. You know, that went on for quite a while and actually really affected my life quite a bit.
Last night, Sebastian, I was talking to a documentary filmmaker and the woman whose life she was documenting, an Australian woman who was pack-raped in Africa and who has spent years trying to seek justice for herself and justice for the perpetrators in a fairly ghastly sort of legal system. And it's interesting, because you say that in the Journal of Traumatic Stress, published in 1992, 94% of rape survivors exhibit signs of extreme trauma immediately afterwards. But it is argued that 9 months later, 47% of rape survivors have recovered enough to resume normal lives.
Yeah, and that's a fairly rapid recovery compared to American soldiers. And, you know, keep in mind, most deployments are not as traumatic as being raped. I spoke with a researcher named Rachel Yehuda in the United States who had studied PTSD in Holocaust survivors, rape victims, and soldiers. And what she said was that the recovery from rape is in some ways simpler than from war, because there is nothing good about the experience, nothing that the person wants to retain. It's just purely horrible. Whereas with war, a lot of what a person's experience in combat is extremely positive. There are very, very tight connections with other people. There's a good deal of, frankly, love within the platoon, of loyalty. All these very positive human values happen in combat way more intensely than in civilian life, and horrible things happen. So how do you separate out those two things and move on? It's extremely hard to.
Will or is the Pentagon starting to dose up its troops beforehand, its pilots, for example, before they go into combat? Are there attempts to treat it in advance?
I don't think you can treat this in advance.
Well, I'm saying, is there a pill, like, you know, an anti-depression pill that is being perhaps tested?
I'm not that I know of. I know they treat soldiers during combat with pills that help them sleep if they're having trouble sleeping because of nightmares, with antidepressants. They do medicate troops in combat to get them through. Which, you know, it's hard to know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. These are natural symptoms to a situation.
Sebastian, I raise it because the Americans in particular have a terrible habit of medicalizing almost everything and finding a pill to pop as a consequence.
Yeah, no, I agree. I've never heard that they were treating people with depression before deployment. I haven't heard that. I think even during deployment, they only treat people who seek help and who feel really disturbed.
I raise this because you write in some ways, you've already said, that it's a universal adaption to danger. It's evolutionary. It's common to mammals. Why then see it as a disorder? From the evolutionary perspective, as you say, it's exactly the response you want to have when your life is in danger.
Yes, and presumably your life is only in danger temporarily. I think it becomes a disorder when it becomes ingrained as in a person as a behavior pattern that doesn't stop. So, you know, 2 years later, you're still jumping at loud noises and extremely emotional, having nightmares. I mean, that obviously is getting in the way of someone's ability to lead their life, and at that point, it really becomes a disorder.
Sebastian, I've always believed that nature's answer, or one of nature's attempts to deal with the dreads and the pains of mortality, is a sense of humour. You know, we can, in fact, to some extent, protect ourselves from the inevitability of death as a philosophical proposition, or anything else we fear or dread, through the effects of humour. And history does show that there is a gallows humour, a dark humour, a defensive humour. Look at Jewish humour, for heaven's sake, and for thousands of years, helping beleaguered communities to cope. Did you observe that humour was important amongst soldiers?
Well, I love that theory, and yes, absolutely. I mean, Restrepo, which is the little outpost I was at, that saw an enormous amount of combat, was really one of the funniest experiences I've ever had. I mean, young men in groups can be incredibly funny, and not just in combat, work crews, roofing crews, whatever. I've been around a lot of working men, and when you get them together in a group and give them a miserable job, the more miserable the job, the funnier they get, and that's certainly true of combat.
But as you point out, it's soldiers who aren't in direct fire, who aren't combat soldiers, who report suffering PTSD at even higher levels. Let's examine that paradox, please, Sebastian.
Well, what it seems to be is that the more well-trained a soldier is, the more in control they feel, even of a very intense combat situation, and so the more they're buffered from PTSD. The people who are quite vulnerable are people who are in moderate amounts of danger but are not very well trained, not very well prepared, because they don't need to be, because they're not frontline combat troops. And that seems to be a very complicated situation. And I've learned since writing the article that was true even back in World War I. But there's also this other thing, which I believe has a very serious consequence, which is, even when soldiers are not exposed to danger, they are exposed to the tremendous intimacy and interreliance of living and working in a platoon, and that when they come back to modern society, they go through a kind of withdrawal where they feel extremely alienated and ill at ease. The only language they have to describe their depression during this transition, the only language they have is the word PTSD, when in fact it actually probably technically isn't that. It's some kind of transition difficulty that I think probably should get its own diagnosis.
Sebastian, one of the extraordinary things in your piece is the interesting fact that unmanned drone pilots, for example, who watch their missiles kill human beings by remote control and remote camera, are calculated to have the same rates as pilots who fly actual combat missions.
Yes, and you know, keep in mind those rates would be lower than frontline combat troops. But still, one of the things that seems to be very, very psychologically destabilizing is watching harm come to others. And that's even true of watching harm come to the enemy soldiers. So in the during the first Gulf War, soldiers reported that seeing enemy soldiers killed was more upsetting, more traumatizing to them than even getting wounded themselves was. And then you see that again in drone pilots. They're watching on a video display rockets, missiles that they're firing, obliterating a group of people or a person. And they're not in danger, right? They're just watching other people die at their hands, and that's extremely disturbing.
I remember too, Sebastian, and I'm sure you know this, that during the First World War, many soldiers found the prospect of killing the enemy so repugnant that they deliberately missed, that there was an incredibly high rate of what is now apparently quite deliberate non-targeting. And that figure has been reduced over the war, over the years and over wars by ever better training of troops.
Well, I think I'm just guessing, but I think what happens when you have mass warfare and you're just one person out of thousands on a trench line, my guess is that you feel that you can shoot over their heads, not personally kill anyone, and it's not going to have any impact on the battle. Either the enemy is going to sweep through your trench line and kill everyone or not, and you won't be, what you do won't have any effect. I could absolutely tell you that out at Restrepo, whether it was a 20-man position, that would get very, very heavily attacked, and there was a real chance of being overrun, and every man counted, every bullet counted. In that situation, they were definitely shooting to kill. They took great delight in killing because every time they killed someone, it meant that they were more likely to survive. So that certainly was not true at Restrepo. And I don't think it was the training. I think it really was the individualistic nature of the combat. These are very small units. These aren't thousands of men lined up in a trench.
There was a very strange noise in the background. I hope they're not coming to get you. Now, Sebastian, suicide. There's a figure of 22 vets a day committing suicide. Is that right?
Apparently, it's around 22 vets a day. What's not commonly known, it's a very misleading figure, what's not commonly known is that 75% of those 22 are over the age of 50. Most of them are Vietnam vets. And that there's no statistical correlation between combat and the likelihood of committing suicide. They're completely unconnected. That does not go with the sort of narrative that's been developed about veteran suicide.
I find that confronting and surprising. I'd accepted that narrative. I think most people had.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, people project their understanding of war and what they believe is that combat is traumatizing, which it is, and that trauma leads people to want to take their own life. They're actually not connected. There's no relationship between the two.
Are there lawyers in America, effectively ambulance chasers, who are seeking to persuade vets to claim PTSD as they would do in almost any other field of with an attempt to drum up business?
You know, soldiers don't, vets don't turn to lawyers to get their benefits. for the most part. It's more of a procedural situation. They fill out the forms and they file them. I was talking about this with a vet recently, and we were saying, in some ways, why wouldn't you want to have PTSD right now? It's emblematic of having served your nation. So there's no dishonor. There's no shame involved. It actually means, it's come to mean you've served your nation. Girls feel sorry for you. And you get to file for disability and get up to 100% disability rating, which is a pretty large check every month. And so there's a lot of, oddly, a sort of incentive to think you have it, or at least claim that you have it.
Over the years, we've also done a number of programs on the fact that the tiny percentage of Americans who actually are put in harm's way, or even back up for those who are in harm's way, is in contrast to the mass of the nation who enjoy war voyeuristically and then become bored by it. And this has led to an argument, and I see that you make it too, that it might be good to mandate national service again so that everyone has to do their share.
Well, I mean, yes, the famous figure, 1% serve, I've pointed out that we probably don't want and certainly can't afford an army where 10% serve. That's not actually really solving the problem. The problem is the relationship between that 1% and the other 99. I think it's immoral. I don't think it's ethical to force people to fight, to put a gun in their hands and to fight if they don't want to. I'm not for that. But I think national service, general national service with a military option would be very, very good for a nation. I think it's one of the reasons that Israel has a low rate of PTSD. It really does bind everyone into this idea.
You're not going to win that argument in the U.S. these days, Sebastian.
Well, people are actually talking about it. I mean, the idea of national service has come up. It's come up with General Stanley McChrystal, who is suggesting voluntary national service, which actually I'm not sure that would quite work. But isn't
that an oxymoron?
Yes, that's, you put your finger on it. But the idea is sort of bubbling up. I mean, obviously, it's a politically charged thing. But I think it would be very good for this nation.
Sebastian, it was a privilege to talk to you. Sebastian Junger, writer, documentary maker, war correspondent extraordinaire. And yes, we will put a link on our website to his Vanity Fair article about this discussion.